The long-term effect of family separations, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Hundreds of kids separated from their families at the border are still awaiting reunification. So what's it like for those kids? This Filipino woman still remembers being separated from her mom as a toddler 4 decades ago.
I was sad every day when she was gone, and I just didn't know who to express that to.
The circumstances were different, but cases like hers remind us that family separations definitely have a long-term impact.
It almost feels like it's affected almost every close relationship that I've had with people.
We'll hear her full story, plus how smuggled American guns are impacting Canada's gun debate. Those stories and much more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. For weeks, we followed the stories of families who arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border and were split apart. Many psychologists have pointed out that even a short separation can affect a person for decades, sometimes a lifetime. So this week, we've been hearing about family separations that took place long ago, way before the Trump era and under different circumstances. The key question is, what are the lingering effects of those separations today? Glady Lee lived in the Philippines away from her parents for nearly 2 years when she was just a toddler. It happened 4 decades ago, but as Sasha Coca of KQED reports, she's still unearthing secrets from that time.
Back in the 1970s, long-distance phone calls were expensive, so Glady Lee remembers her family mailing cassette tapes back and forth to stay connected. When she was just 2, her parents got visas to work in the U.S. Her mom was a nurse. Glady and her brother stayed behind with their grandparents in the Philippines. She remembers them taking out the tape recorder.
Glady, come here. It's time for you to say hi to your mom and your dad. Do you want them to bring you anything from the States?
And you saw this.
Yeah, then I found these other ones, but we don't know what's on them either.
Yeah, but this is so...
Today, Glady and her mom, Nella, are looking for those tapes in Nella's kitchen in Vallejo, north of San Francisco. Okay. They plug in an old boom box.
So anyway...
Should we put it in? Let's put it in.
And listen? I don't know what's in there.
So daddy couldn't have to guess, so mommy couldn't.
On one tape from 1978, we hear Glady, age 4, speaking Tagalog. But this tape isn't from the Philippines. It's from after she and her brother finally got to California. She's telling her grandparents about kindergarten and the family's one-bedroom apartment.
I'm a kindergarten.
And then there's the tape sent back from Glady's grandparents.
Magpapatay tayo ng maraming chicken doon.
That's them promising to kill a lot of chickens so they can feast next time the kids visit. But many of the tapes are lost or broken. Maybe the sounds from that critical time apart have been erased. But not in Glady's mind. It's all still vivid and painful, even at age 44. When we talk alone, away from her parents, Glady tells me when she was a toddler, everyone in the Philippines told her she wasn't supposed to be sad. Her parents had made it to America.
That was the dream. And so the dream was happening for my family.
But that's not how it felt to a child.
I was sad every day when she was gone. And I just didn't know who to express that to. All the feelings that we had about being separated, it's almost like it was swept under the rug.
The pain came back again this summer with the stories of families separated at the border. Glady says she heard one story about a father whose child held in a detention center was asking frantic questions.
Don't you love me? Why did you leave me? Why can't we be together? So when you're a child, those are the only things that you really care about.
Glady was reunited with her parents when she was 4. But after nearly 2 years apart, it wasn't just joyful hugs and kisses. Glady still has scars.
It almost feels like it's affected almost every close relationship that I've had with people.
Or any relationship, like the one with her children's violin teacher who's moving away.
I mean, like, the idea of her leaving just kind of sets me off. And just people leaving is very traumatic. And it's just the violin teacher, you know?
Gladys' boys are now 10 and 14. When they were younger, she stayed home for a few years. She wanted to be there during their toddler years because her mom and dad couldn't be there for hers. But she's grateful her parents got her to California where she could make that choice.
They put us through college and we have jobs. So that's how it's come full circle, I guess.
Yeah.
Back at her parents' house in California, Gladys joins them on the couch to look at old photo albums. The plastic pages are worn and brittle.
Oh,
look at that.
In one photo, Gladys is two, adorable in a pink sundress, but she looks sad and confused.
So that was the day you left for the States, right, Mom? That was the day you left?
Yes, yes. That was 1976.
It looks like to me like you were crying.
Yeah.
But her mom ignores that. It's only when I press her that she opens up.
Yeah. And so when you had your two young children and this was the day when you were leaving, how did you feel?
I guess it's like a mixed feeling because when I was young, I said I really wanted to be a registered nurse and then go to America.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really completely feel that the separation will be that bad. And so I realized I had been crying and really missed them.
And then her dad reveals something huge, something Gladys never knew before. He and his wife didn't choose to leave their kids behind in the Philippines. They had to. They couldn't get their kids a visa.
We applied all at the same time, but the consul took them off, the two kids, because the consul said to establish ourselves here first.
I didn't know that. What was the original plan?
That all of us were coming over here together? All at the same time.
Mm. Yeah. Okay.
Gladys' mom knew it would be a painful sacrifice in order to get to California.
Oh, my goodness. Every night that you will be in that awful situation thinking about your children. Mm-hmm. I could still cry.
Her mom puts a hand on Gladys' back, then chokes up and hugs her. But Gladys remains stiff. She's still protecting her parents from her pain.
I know, Mom.
I know. I'm so glad that I have a daughter.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You're doing good, right?
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Later, I ask Gladys how that felt, finally seeing her mom cry about the separation. Gladys says she realized her mom felt guilty about that time. And when she felt her mom's hand on her back, it was like she was acknowledging the little girl she left behind. For The World, Sasha Coca, Vallejo, California.
As we've been hearing, the issue of family separations isn't a new one. It's been happening in many places and for many different reasons. In Canada, there's a rising concern about the number of Indigenous or First Nations children placed in foster care. Indigenous children make up 7% of the total of kids in Canada, but they represent nearly half of the children in foster care.
We have thousands, tens of thousands of Indigenous children being removed from their homes and put into foster care group homes, and it's been a crisis for a long time.
Kenneth Jackson is with the Aboriginal People's Television Network in Ottawa. He's done a lot of reporting on First Nations children in foster care, including a disturbing incidence of suicide and death. He recently spoke with my colleague, Marco Werman.
So why are these children being removed from their homes?
Some kids need to be removed from their home. Let's say it's just that bad. They're being abused, or there are going to be those cases. And poverty stretches to addiction, to that sort of thing. So all the kids I write about that have died, they were never abused at home. They were never sexually abused. They were never hit. Their parents had they had addictions. Like, you have cases where it has to happen, but it's known now, and our Canadian government has admitted this, that poverty should never be the reason why a kid is removed, and there needs to be a transformation into how we approach child welfare in Canada.
Yeah, so you've seen fatalities. I want to know how the separation has affected the kids and their families. What have you seen in your reporting?
Well, I'll give you an example. Back in February, I've been writing about these girls in Ontario. Four died within 6 months and lived in group homes in different areas. And the one was named Kanina Sioux Turtle. She was 15. February, like a lawyer contacted me and said he had this video of his girl dying by suicide. This girl filmed her suicide in a foster home. And I was like, holy, you know, that's Kenina. I've been writing about her. She would always be told by the agency, child welfare agency, two more months. Well, those 2 more months turns into like 2 or 3 years to the point where I think a lot of these kids that are dying by suicide, it's their way out. And when she died, it was like a ripple effect, chain reaction. There was 2 other girls that died shortly thereafter, all suicides. Yeah.
So how much of this are you seeing?
You know, in Ontario, 30 a year. Like, they're not all dying, don't get me wrong. Like, this isn't like a blanket statement every kid in care is dying, but our numbers are high. I would say, you know, one's too high. But talking about dozens across Canada every year.
Canada has been through this before, and I know you're not clear about why this is happening now, this child separation for First Nations kids, but what do you see as a connection between what is happening now in Canada and the history of the government's treatment of First Nations children?
Well, I don't think it's ever changed. All we have in Canada is called the Indian Act, and that is basically a department, a federal department in law set up for First Nations people. And within the Indian Act, they developed residential schools where they took the kids from their home, 150,000 over 100 years, something like that. And that ended in 1996. Well, in the 60s, the government changed the laws where they downloaded child welfare onto the provinces across Canada, and that developed a 60s scoop where kids were taken from their home very much a similar way and put into adoption, and they're all over the world now.
Right.
Those kids, you know what I mean? So kind of this current government is now trying to develop a system, change the system. So you can imagine changing a system over 200 some years, and now you're trying to correct that wrong. And they're doing that by trying to focus on prevention. Like, how do we keep the kids in their communities, in their homes, close to home, instead of apprehending? Because that's been the model since forever, is take the kids.
Kenneth Jackson with the Aboriginal People's Television Network speaking with us from Ottawa. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Let's take a minute now to talk about a story we're working on for tomorrow's show. It's about Yemenis in the United States whose families are still in Yemen, which has become a humanitarian disaster.
There's airplanes, there's wars, there's lack of a government. It's like death is awaiting you.
They want to bring their loved ones to safety in the U.S., but President Trump's travel ban bars them from coming. There is a waiver. Problem is, waivers are hard to get.
It's become very, very clear that there is no waiver process. People are not getting individualized consideration, and they're not even getting the opportunity to submit documents.
How a travel ban is dividing families, sometimes with tragic results. That story tomorrow. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Lots of coastal communities in Mexico and around the world depend on fishing to survive. It's an increasingly precarious living, though. Fish populations just about everywhere are in trouble. Many fishing communities respond by trying to hang on no matter what. That rarely ends well. But a handful of tiny towns in Mexico's Baja California are trying something different. They're putting entire areas off limits to fishing altogether in the hopes that the fish will come back. And the strategy seems to be working. From our Livable Planet desk, here's reporter Deepa Fernandez.
Jesus Enrique Leon Lara is from Agua Verde, a tiny village on the southern coast of Baja California. For many years, Leon says, all my family, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, we've all been fishermen. We've lived off fishing all our lives. We lived off what we caught, from what the ocean gave us, Leon says. There was so much fish, so many types of fish, he says. But now, well, it's not like that. There's a lot less fish. I heard the same story from communities around the Baja coast. Locals, even sports fishermen from the U.S. A day's fishing might yield very little, even nothing.
There used to be a lot more fish in the water all over Baja California.
Hudson Weaver runs the Sustainable Fisheries Program at a nonprofit called Ni Paraha and has worked in Agua Verde for 12 years. She says there are lots of reasons why there are now fewer fish around Baja.
The changes we've seen in a lot of the climate and the water temperatures. There's natural changes like sardines that go through boom and bust cycles. And then there's, you know, changes in the fisheries, so overfishing or fishing past the point of being able to replenish those fish in a yearly fashion.
Fishing boats, big and small, used to come here from all over Mexico. Even the local fishermen themselves were just catching too many fish. All these things together ultimately brought some fishing communities here to the breaking point. I'm cutting over the sloppy ocean near a tiny village called Cabo Pulmo with a former fisherman, Mario Castro.
Aquí venía yo a pescar todas estas zonas.
This is where I used to come and fish, Castro tells me.
Lleno de peces.
And it was full of sea bass and grouper. But that changed. Some days, he says,
y a veces no traíamos ni un pez.
They would come back without a single fish. So 20 years ago, Castro and his former fishermen took a radical step. They turned almost the entire area into a no-fishing zone, and the results have been dramatic.
Tortuga! Tortuga!
Castro's son spots a sea turtle.
Tortuga.
We watch its head bob up and go under. Castro tells me they're seeing wildlife here that even some of his old uncles don't ever remember seeing. After 2 decades of not fishing at all, the ocean here is full of fish. It's true. This little patch of ocean has become a case study in underwater regeneration, if you ask Octavio Burto, a marine biologist who's been studying Cabo Pulmo for all those 20 years.
The corals are growing faster and better. Why? Because they are healthier.
The corals are the feeding ground for the littlest fish, and those now have the chance to grow into food for the big predators, like sharks, which Burto says are also back. Altogether, he says, the fishing ban has helped restore a thriving ocean ecosystem.
When you have a community that has all the elements for that community, like big predators, herbivores, corals, sea fans, octopuses, when you have everything there, the community is stronger. And each of the species within the communities, they can be more productive.
Abruto was part of a group of scientists at the University of Baja California Sur who worked on setting up the no-fishing zone. They even petitioned the Mexican government to have the area declared a national park. Former fisherman Mario Castro worked with the scientists and ultimately became the local leader in the effort. It was no easy task. Castro had to convince all the fishermen that the short-term economic loss might mean more stability in the longer term. And it meant suspending a way of life that was generations old. But he managed to convince his old uncles and father and brother, all the fishermen in the village, to give it a go. Before long, Castro says, they watched beautiful fish begin to return. But they stuck with the no-fishing plan. Instead, they thought they could make Cabo Pulmo into a destination for diving and snorkeling. Fishermen would become guides. Castro was one of the first to get certified. But it was a rough transition. It was 10 years of suffering, he says. With just one tourist coming to dive a week, well, with this, you can't even eat. They kept one tiny sliver of the ocean as an area that locals could fish, but just for daily consumption. Still, they stuck with the plan, and virtually all fishing stopped. Castro's son, David, is prepping equipment for a dive with a group of tourists. Cabo Pulmo is now a hot place for divers, and showing the underwater wonders to visitors is now a thriving business for Mario Castro and other former fisher folk. So much so, they've decided not to go back to fishing. They see their future in dive tourism. And the town's experiment may be an example to other fishing communities in the region. José Flores is the head of a fishing cooperative in La Paz, about 90 miles up the Baja coast from Cabo Pulmo. He grew up on this beach, fishing for what his family ate every day. But here too, the fish started to run out. When Flores heard about the no-fishing zones, the idea seemed risky, but it also seemed to be working in other places. So he joined an effort to help establish one here in La Paz. It was a tough sell here too, but Flores says it's working. Flores tells me how after a few years the whole area improved and the richness of the ocean life returned.
saqueados por gente de otros estados.
But he says it's been challenging to make sure that everyone respects the boundaries, especially people who come here from out of town. They've had to work with the government and locals to enforce the restrictions. These young people are from the remote community of Agua Verde, where Jesus Leon Lara lives, and which also established its own small no-fishing zone. They're in La Paz for a week-long diving training with sustainable fishing organization Ni Paraha. But this is not about becoming underwater tour guides. These kids are learning how to patrol their no-fishing zone back home. They'll also help to document and catalogue changes in the abundance of fish over time to help determine whether their experiment is actually working. Ultimately, the data could help make the case for expanding the protected zone. Initial results indicate the fish are coming back to Agua Verde, and Jesus Leon Lara is relieved. There's no other way, he says. Unlike Cabo Pulmo, his part of Baja is just too remote to attract many tourists. So if his community is going to survive, it really needs the fish to come back. For The World, Deepa Fernandez, Baja California Sur.
I'm Carol Hills. After a spate of shootings, Canada is debating whether it needs stricter gun control, even though there are fewer guns per capita there than here in the U.S.
One of the challenges we have is that Canadians pat themselves on the back a lot because we compare ourselves to the U.S.
That story just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. One of the hottest public debates in Canada this summer concerns guns. Last week in New Brunswick, four people, including two police officers, were fatally shot. A few weeks before that in Toronto, a shooter killed two people and injured 13 others. And a month before that, two sisters, a 5 and 9-year-old, were shot on a playground. Unlike Americans, Canadians are not used to this amount of gun violence. People are worried the country's changing and that the U.S. may have a role in the increasing violence. The World's Rupa Shenoy has been exploring the issue.
On a Sunday night, about 3 weeks ago, Jerry Pinkson and his girlfriend Danielle Kane took a friend out for a birthday dinner. They went to the Danforth, a really hip area in Toronto with lots of bars and restaurants.
And we were on the patio, and all of a sudden we heard like what we thought were gunshots. And then we start talking about the recent gun violence that's been in the city and stuff like that.
That's when the restaurant waiters came over and hustled them inside.
And I didn't hear any sirens. We didn't know what was going on. And then this woman came up to us that was in the front of the building, was hysterical. And she's saying, "I just saw someone get shot."
Pinkson felt like he had to help. He and Kane are nurses. He waited a few minutes and didn't hear more gunshots, so he went outside.
I looked across the street. I saw an individual who was walking calmly. I didn't think anything of it. And then I heard a clicking sound, like a weapon, like something being reloaded or sound. And then I looked back and I saw him stare at us. And he threw his arms up in the air and pointed the gun at us and started firing.
Pinkson ducked. Bullets were flying over his head. He didn't think to look behind him. So he didn't realize his girlfriend, Danielle Kane, had followed him out of the restaurant.
I didn't know until I heard her scream, and then I just, like, oh my God.
She was lying in a doorway. Pinkson dragged her inside and told her to breathe.
I was scared, and then I realized that I can't, and I had to help and try to keep her, speak talking and try to keep her alive, because I was like, I still need her. I need her here. I can't go without her.
Kane had been shot in the spine. The gunman, 29-year-old Faisal Hussein, injured others and killed an 18-year-old woman and 10-year-old girl before dying in an exchange of gunfire with police. His parents say Hussein had a history of mental illness. Police say he wasn't connected to terrorists. They haven't said where Hussein got the handgun. For lots of people in Toronto, that night at the Danforth confirmed a troubling pattern. Gun deaths are increasing in the city. They've nearly doubled in the last 4 years. There have been 30 so far this year. So the day after the shootings at the Danforth, Toronto Mayor John Tory wondered aloud,
"Why does anyone in this city need to have a gun at all?"
He's since asked Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to ban handguns in Toronto, increase penalties for gun trafficking, and do more to stop cross-border gun smuggling.
As I've said repeatedly, this is an international problem and this is a domestic problem. There are far too many people carrying around guns in our city and our region who should not have them.
It's pretty normal for Canadians to have rifles. Handguns and automatics have only been getting popular recently. The number of them registered in Canada increased by a third from 2012 to 2016, now topping a million. But that's still a small number compared to estimates of firearms in the U.S. Wendy Sukier is president of the Coalition for Gun Control and a professor at Ryerson University in Toronto.
One of the challenges we have is that Canadians pat themselves on the back a lot because we compare ourselves to U.S. And, of course, if you look at Chicago, which is the same size as Toronto, Chicago had 10 times as many gun murders last year as we did. But I would argue we need to set our sights higher. We should be looking elsewhere for our standards, not south of the border.
There's another issue from south of the border. Many handguns involved in crimes come from the States. Sukier says historically in Toronto, about two-thirds of handguns used in crimes came from the U.S.
It would be great if the United States had better gun control because that would benefit all of us. But the fact remains that a significant proportion of the guns that are misused originate in Canada. We need stricter controls on handguns. We need a complete ban on military assault weapons. We need stronger screening.
Many Canadian handgun owners, though, argue more laws and regulations won't solve the problem because legal gun license holders already follow a lot of rules. The Canadian Coalition for Firearm Rights invited me out to the Silverdale Gun Club, about an hour south of Toronto, off a dirt road in a rural area.
Hi.
Coalition member Dave Partnan helped me sign in with a woman at the counter.
Good morning.
Hi.
I have another guest coming in today.
We have a lot of guests.
I do.
Yes. Yeah, so what is it that you actually do down there?
I evangelize.
Partnan says he's evangelized about guns in Canada ever since he had an epiphany.
I like to call it my road to Damascus moment because it was just everything changed about my perceptions of everything.
He says he'd been raised and conditioned by TV and movies to see guns as unsafe and criminal. But 4 years ago, his wife got him a gift certificate for a session with a gun instructor. Partnan says once he understood how strict Canadian gun laws are, especially compared to the U.S., he became convinced that owning and shooting handguns is a safe hobby.
It's no different than playing hockey.
But it takes a lot more than buying some equipment to start the sport of shooting. Partnan had to complete a 2-day safety training course with written and practical exams. Then there was a federal background check.
You have to provide spousal consent if you're married. You have to provide names and contact information for any conjugal partners that you've had in the last 2 years. They ask for medication history, mental health history. They want to know that you're gainfully employed, that you haven't had any kind of financial setback that's going to put you over the edge and all that.
The process took 8 months. Now, Partnan, who's a software developer, has a collection of handguns and semi-automatic rifles.
I'm going to open up my rifle bag here.
He shows me how he keeps the guns locked in individual cases, separate from his ammunition. Partnan's licenses only allow him to transport his firearms here, and he can only shoot them here.
In the wake of these horrible incidents that happened in Toronto, and, you know, we hear more and more of all the time, the common knee-jerk reaction among politicians and legislators and all that is to say, well, we got to put tougher restrictions in place. And when you look at the regulatory environment that we're in, I don't understand how clamping down on the people that are complying with the law is going to make any difference because we're not the problem.
While Canadians have been debating how to prevent things like what happened at the Danforth, Jerry Pinkson has been sitting by his girlfriend Danielle Kane's hospital bed. She woke from a coma a few days ago. He took a break to meet me outside the hospital.
If I was in the same situation, I would still do it again.
Pinkson's heard about the Toronto mayor's proposal to ban handguns. He thinks it's a good idea, even though he doesn't think a ban would have stopped what happened at the Danforth.
What happened that night at Danforth wasn't a security issue. It's a society issue. It's a social issue.
Society hasn't learned to help people with mental illness, he says. Partnan says that's the best way to reduce gun violence, not by allowing more people to carry guns, as is sometimes argued in the States.
I grew up in a household where we had many guns, but our view was saying that our guns are for hunting, for subsistence, for providing food for us. And when I hear about Americans, when they think of guns, their first instinct is protection. And I feel bad because I wouldn't want to live in a place where you feel that you need to carry a gun for protection. I want to make sure I live in a place that I feel safe, not having the need for a gun.
Canada may decide what kind of place it is soon. Prime Minister Trudeau's considering a national handgun ban. He said he'd make a decision about that this month. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Toronto.
This movie comes out today.
March. We've been dating for over a year now, and I think it's about time people met my beautiful girlfriend. What about us taking an adventure east?
Like Queens?
I'll give you a hint. Queens is not where the adventure happens. The main character is Rachel, and her boyfriend wants to take her back to his home country to meet his friends and family. But when she gets there, she has to fend off jealous socialites and meddling family members who want to break up their relationship. Oh, and Rachel's surprised to find out just how rich Nick's family is. It sort of sounds like your typical romantic comedy, except it's set in Singapore, and it's the first Hollywood movie to feature a majority East Asian cast in 25 years. Maybe you already guessed it. We're talking about the new movie, Crazy Rich Asians. Pierre Pong is an actor in the movie. He plays a character named Michael Tew. He's speaking to us from Singapore. Pierre, tell us about Michael, the character you play in Crazy Rich Asians.
He's born and bred in Singapore. He fell crazily in love with Astrid Leong. They soon learned the hard way that being in love with each other meant they have to go through a lot of tests and trials, mainly because Michael Teo fell in love with the richest and sexiest girl in Singapore. So their marriage was not going to be an easy marriage. Will their love overcome the obstacles ahead of them? Coming from different social backgrounds, I would say you just have to catch the movie to find out.
Is it a big deal that a big film like this is being made in Singapore? I mean, did Singaporean actors go, whoa, yay? You know, did everybody line up?
Yeah, there was huge buzz about it when they were holding auditions for the movie. And, well, I just have to say, for me, it's like a dream come true. Personally, I mean, I'm just this simple boy that grew up watching Hollywood movies all my life. And now I'm starring in one. I couldn't have had it any better. Playing a Singaporean character in a Hollywood movie, my first ever, you can't get better than that.
The film Crazy Rich Asians, it spurred a conversation about representation that's going on social media, like so many things, especially because Asian actors only get 1% of leading roles in Hollywood films. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I come from Singapore, and very fortunately, I don't experience any of that. But looking back, I do remember watching a lot of movies where the Asian characters are being portrayed as either some geek or some kingpin or some tri-gangster, some leader, or maybe, yeah, even a prostitute, some kung fu master. These characters are very memorable in most of the Hollywood movies that I've watched. So my thought on it is, I don't really care why it didn't happen. Why wasn't it done sooner? As far as I'm concerned, there's a movement going on right now. We are getting a lot more attention. I said it before, I mean, 60% of the world's population are Asians. So we are only just starting to get a chance, the opportunity to showcase our lifestyles, our love stories, our experiences.
There's also been some criticism that the movie doesn't really represent Singapore, which is extremely multicultural as a whole, that it only features East Asians and that everybody seems to have light skin. And where are the other ethnic groups of Singapore? Why aren't they featured more in this movie? What do you think about that?
Well, firstly, this movie is a romantic comedy, and it just so happens to be set in Singapore. Well, the story is not about being a Singaporean, not about how you can be a Singaporean. It's a love story seen through the eyes of an Asian American. So I've watched the movie twice, and coming from a true blue Singaporean, I feel really proud that the movie featured the hospitality of a typical Asian family, a mother's love for her son, the friendship between good friends, and more importantly, our obsession with food.
With food?
Yeah. You may not have heard this, but Singapore is Asia paradise for food. I've known people who actually travel with their own special brew of chili sauce or maybe some sweet condiment to go with their food.
So the food of Singapore really represents the range of cultures that live there.
That is correct.
This is an easy question, but I'll ask it anyway. Why do you think Crazy Rich Asians is an important film to see?
Just looking at love from a different perspective is something that... especially something as generic as a father's love for his son or the friendship between childhood friends is different from another country, especially coming from an Asian culture where the beliefs and the practices are slightly different. I think it is something that can be appreciated both by different cultures. You know, so it's a movie for everyone. It's a feel-good movie, and no better reason to watch a movie than to walk out of the movie feeling good.
Pierre Pong is a Singaporean actor who's part of the cast of Crazy Rich Asians, a romantic comedy that opens today at a theater near you. Thanks, Pierre.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you for having me.
We want to tell you a bit more now about yesterday's bridge collapse in the Italian city of Genoa. The death toll has risen to 39. Italian news outlets are saying that some experts had long warned that the Morandi Bridge was deteriorating. Officials are launching a criminal investigation. There were many witnesses, people far and close, who watched as a huge section of the bridge fell away. Among them, a British couple on vacation who talked to my BBC colleague, James Reynolds.
We were driving from Balestino to Rapel yesterday, and because of the weather, we decided to take the faster route along the motorway, and we came out of the tunnel. The rain was torrential, and as we drove along, we felt the car slide to the right. It felt like very high winds, thinking we were on a tall bridge, and we kept going, and then all of a sudden we saw lots of red lights, all the cars in front braking. We could only see a couple of cars ahead of us. Then all of a sudden, all the reverse lights came on.
People started shouting, waving their arms to reverse out the windows.
And tooting horns and everything like that. And so we tried to reverse and we couldn't go anywhere. And the car in front hit the front of our car. And then people were running, screaming in Italian, run,
everyone, out.
Out
cars.
Cars. So we just literally, kids, run, run.
Because you have a 12-year-old and a 9-year-old.
Yes, yeah. We do. And our daughter's got hemiplegia, which is a form of cerebral palsy. So we made our son just run. And we sort of grabbed our daughter's hand and started running. But we couldn't pick her up because all the car doors were flying open, people everywhere.
You had no idea that the road ahead had collapsed?
No.
What did you think had happened?
I don't know, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I really didn't have a clue. I just knew it didn't feel right on the bridge. And when we ran in...
Did there'd been an earthquake or something? I don't know. And then someone shouted, collapse.
Stay. The lorry drivers sort of took control a bit and got everybody off the bridge into the tunnel. And then it just seemed forever and we waited. And some police appeared. We think they were probably on the bridge. There were all nationalities there that
couldn't
speak. Everybody
was translating for everybody sort of thing. You know, there was people there with pets in carriers, pregnant.
How many people?
Oh, there must have been at least 60. 60 of us stood in the entrance of the tunnel.
Do you know how far ahead of you was the collapse?
We were just after the bend, and having seen the pictures on the TV since, maybe another 100 metres.
A couple of 100 metres.
So another 100 metres means a few seconds in driving time. If you'd been a few seconds ahead of where you'd have been...
If we hadn't stopped before we entered the tunnel for a rest, that's is a nightmare.
Don't want to think about it.
How did you explain to your kids what had happened?
We were always truthful with them. We told them what had happened. We tried to steer.
Said they were safe. We were in the tunnel.
It doesn't matter about anything in the car. And
we were together as a family, and that's what mattered.
That's Nicola and Lisa Henton Mitchell talking with the BBC's James Reynolds. Finally today, a story about closure, a closure delayed by decades for one family. An American soldier who died during World War II has finally been identified more than 70 years later and his remains buried alongside those of his twin brother. Jake Siganaro has the story from northern France.
Now, unto Almighty God, we commit his body.
On an overcast day this summer, at the Normandy American Cemetery, a small group gathered to memorialize a fallen soldier. Today, this American soldier, who was previously unidentified, is finally getting a proper burial 74 years after his death. But it might be better to call this funeral a reunion. The ceremony is for Henry Pieper, a Navy radio operator from Nebraska, who died alongside his twin brother, Louis. Louis's body was recovered immediately, and he's been buried in France since D-Day. But Henry's body was never found, and his name was placed on the Normandy Cemetery Wall of the Missing. The twins' namesake, Louis Henry Pieper, their nephew, says it was always too painful for his father, their brother, to share memories.
Dad didn't want to open up an unknown. It was always a wound in his heart, not knowing where his brother was, so he never talked about it.
Growing up in Creston, Nebraska, the Pieper twins were inseparable. When they enlisted, their parents were relieved they deployed together on the same ship. Susan Lawrence is their niece.
In order to comfort my grandparents, they had written a letter a couple of days prior to their death that said, "Do not worry about us, we are together."
But they were separated in death, and Henry might have been lost forever if it weren't for a high school student living a couple of hours from his hometown. In 2015, Vanessa Taylor, then a junior in Ainsworth, Nebraska, was researching fallen soldiers for a school project. She was going through an online list of soldiers from her home state. She noticed two had the same last name.
So we looked into it and we found out that they were brothers, twins, and that they were in the same branch of the military, that they were even in the same ship when they died.
Taylor got in touch with the twins' only living sibling, their sister, Mary Ann Lawrence, and learned that Henry was MIA. She requested Henry's personnel file from the Defense MIA and POW Accounting Agency, which is in charge of finding missing soldiers. For decades following his death, Henry's case was silent. But when Taylor made that request, the agency had already begun reviewing cases of buried unidentified soldiers. In 1961, unidentified remains had been excavated from Henry's and Louis' shipwreck and transferred to the Ardennes Cemetery in Belgium. Call it fate or lucky timing, but Taylor's request sparked an aha moment for the investigators. Tim Nozel is from the American Battle Monuments Commission.
So as DPA is looking at the files, they know that there's a sailor missing from this particular landing ship. And here comes this other type of file, this individual deceased personnel file, talking about a sailor who's missing from this landing ship, and two pieces of the puzzle come together.
A few weeks before the funeral, the twins' last living sibling, Mary Ann Lawrence, died at age 88. But her daughter, Susan Lawrence, says she knew her brothers would finally be reunited.
For her, it was like the biggest burden lifted off her shoulders. It's like she was just carrying it all this time, you know, what happened to the brother, and to have him identified, to know that he is found, it was the biggest blessing.
Henry's fresh grave is a symbol of his sacrifice, as well as peace for his family. But it's also a reminder that approximately 72,000 Americans from World War II are still missing in action. For the world, I'm Jake Siganaro in Colville-sur-Mer, Normandy.
That's all from us today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. See you again tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.